The headlines. Iran's leader describes the coronavirus outbreak as the main problem that his country is facing, calling on officials to take all necessary measures to fight the pandemic. The campaign group says the UK is pushing poor countries to the back of the COVID vaccine queue by ordering millions of overpriced booster jabs. Also in the headlines, Sudan says it will hand over former ruler Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted to over the Darfur conflict. Thanks for joining us. The leader of Iran's Islamic Revolution says that the coronavirus pandemic is the main problem that the country is facing. Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei urged officials to provide vaccines, both through imports and domestic production. He also slammed some foreign countries for failing to abide by the promises in providing vaccines to Iranians. Ayatollah Khamenei warned that the country's health staff is grappling with a great deal of pressure amid a steep rise in cases and deaths. He also urged all Iranian citizens to abide by health protocols in an effort to deal with the crisis. The Iranian-made COVID-19 vaccine, dubbed Nura, has wrapped up its first human trial phase. Developers of the new jab say that the vaccine also provides immunity for children between 12 and 20, aside from adults. Yusuf Jalali reports.
Meet Nura, an Iranian-made COVID vaccine, which is now making a name for itself. Developed by Iran's Baghiyat Allah University, affiliated to the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps, the vaccine wrapped up the first human trial stage and now kick-started the second phase.
The first trial phase involved giving the jabs to 70 people. The vaccine has not created any serious side effects in the volunteers, so we can now conclude that the vaccine is safe. The second phase will cover up to 500 volunteers, and the third and final stage will inject Nura to at least 20,000 people. It's only then we can decide on the efficiency of the vaccine.
Nura is a recombinant vaccine, which experts say provides stronger immune response to the virus compared to jabs that work based on other methods, such as mRNA and inactivated virus. Nura is administered in three stages. The first and second doses are injected 21 days apart, and the third one is administered 2 weeks after the second shot.
Well, Nura jumped a bit late on the bandwagon to fight the coronavirus. It stands out as the only Iranian vaccine that can be administered to children and teens. Experts hope that this would make it safe to reopen schools.
With less than 1 month and a half left to the upcoming school season, authorities in Iran are still debating whether or not to resume in-person classes, which have in the past year given way to online learning. Nura developers say they're trying their best to get their jabs to the market, as they're certain that their vaccine will protect children between 12 and 18 against the coronavirus.
Based on our studies, our vaccine is both safe and effective to be used for people between 12 and 18 years old. Simultaneously with the second trial phase, we'll also kickstart the first stage of the trials on volunteers from this age group.
Developers say if all goes as planned, Nura will hit the market in 3 months. This as Iran has already rolled out its first local vaccine, dubbed Coviran, with a monthly output of up to 15 million doses per month. The country also plans to release Covpars, among other jabs, within the next 2 months. Yusuf Jalali, Tehran.
Campaign group says the UK is pushing poor countries to the back of the COVID vaccine queue by ordering millions of overpriced booster jabs from the pharmaceutical giant Pfizer. Global Justice Now said that it is shamefully unsurprising that Pfizer is increasing its prices for the UK in the middle of a pandemic, so that this is while billions of people remain unvaccinated in countries that can ill afford this kind of profiteering. The UN Health Agency has been sounding the alarm over glaring and growing imbalance in vaccine availability. The situation has been described as vaccine apartheid. The WHO has called for a moratorium on booster shots in a bid to vaccinate 10% of every country's population by the end of September. The U.S. has rejected the call, while the U.K. has also ignored it. Let's find out more about the story. Saeed Fuhrizar is our correspondent who joins us. Saeed, so we know that you gave out a report on this, but it slips my mind. the name of that bank that the vaccines are supposed to go to, in which it was supposed to provide vaccines to countries around the world. Again, I'm sorry, it slips my mind. Why isn't that either being executed or for it to have stopped being functional in this environment?
Gov, good to be with you. I don't have the answer to that question, but if I were to address the story that you just read, I would say that this is really a classic case of after us the deluge. These richer countries, more affluent countries, buying the lion's share of the vaccine output and leaving the low or middle income countries really fighting for scraps. To quote one of the scientists who has commented on the story. You mentioned the term vaccine apartheid earlier in the past few months or year. There was talk of vaccine nationalization, and the term is self-explanatory. They're buying so many of these vaccines, the surplus that they will have will be enough to inoculate all the people in 10 of the world's least vaccinated people. And you just said earlier that they are ignoring calls from the WHO to announce a moratorium on the purchase of those surpluses. So is the United States. We heard from the United Nations Secretary General and again the WHO, and indeed everybody who is concerned about all of this, telling these richer countries to do the same, but they are not listening. And I think Max Lawson, the head of Oxfam's inequality policy, really said it best. He said the British government is ignoring the WHO's advice, issuing booster shots and dogmatically defending vaccine patents, meaning that they are not allowing the transfer of intellectual property to countries that are lower income or middle income to produce their own vaccines. The danger in that, he goes on to say, is that it's ultimately going to cause more deaths. And let's not forget, as many scientists have been saying, all it takes to nullify the vaccination programs in these countries, the richer countries, is the emergence of a new vaccine-resistant variant of this killer virus. And it is likely for that to happen. And so these countries have to take that into consideration, but the calls from the WHO and the rest are falling on deaf ears. But another question that has to be asked is, why are they doing this? Why is this happening? Look at the track record of the conservative government here since this whole thing began. It all came after the Brexit saga and the ongoing story of over the Northern Ireland Protocol, the trade deal with the European Union, and all the rest of it that's caused a lot of waves in this country, followed by the quitting by Johnson, the Prime Minister, Boris Johnson's top aide, who came out later in the past few months really making those inflammatory comments about the Prime Minister and other members of his cabinet. The scandal involving the now former Health Secretary Matt Hancock. All of those, what they need is really some kind of distraction to tell their electorate, their support base, look at what we're doing. Look how great our vaccine rollout is doing. And admittedly, it has been successful. But again, we have to remember that all it takes to really undermine their vaccine rollout is the likely emergence of that vaccine-resistant variant. And if that happens, then all of this really will have been for nothing. What is also important to remember that they're really, if you look at the polls, this government really has taken a hit in terms of popularity ratings, and so they're really turning people's attention to other issues. For example, look how hard and tough we are on immigration, a story that has been really in the headlines recently, deporting people of certain origins back to their home countries. So that is really the crux of the matter, at the very heart of the matter, a government trying to shift people's attention away from its failures. And at the end of the day, what will people remember? They will remember how well the government performed, or the outcome, really, of the government's efforts throughout this pandemic. If they emerge victorious, if everybody is vaccinated, and if they announce the pandemic over, and then, well, they can really stand to rake in the benefits of their actions. But if it goes the other way, then really they will have a lot of answering to do, Kabir.
Thank you for that. Pleasure talking to you. Saeed Pourreza there from London, a correspondent. Thank you. On to South Korea. South Korea has reported a record number of over 2,200 daily COVID-19 cases, the highest since the pandemic started last January.
With the recent spread of the more transmissible Delta variant virus, the number of confirmed cases is increasing, showing mass infection cases from workplaces, indoor sport facilities, churches, and nursing hospitals. Along with that, the rate of investigating the path of infection is also rising, which means silent spreaders within communities is increasing.
Health Minister Kwon Dok-chol says infections have increased due to the spread of the more transmissible Delta variant and a rise in domestic travel over the summer. He urged people who return from holidays to voluntarily get tested before going back to work. The South Korean health officials have so far registered more than 216,000 cases with over 2,100 deaths. Some 42% of the country's 52 million population have received at least one dose of the vaccine, while the government's target is to increase the number to 70% by September. Sudan says it will hand over former ruler Omar al-Bashir to the International Criminal Court, along with other officials wanted over the Darfur conflict. The Sudanese Foreign Minister Mariam al-Mahdi said the cabinet has decided to hand over the officials to face justice. The decision, however, needs approval in a meeting between the cabinet and the Sovereign Council, which is a joint military and civilian body formed to run Sudan's transitional government. The ICC discussed with Sudanese officials to speed up the process. Bashir ruled Sudan for 3 decades before being deposed in 2019. He's facing charges of genocide, war crimes, and crimes against humanity in Darfur. According to the UN, 300,000 people were killed and 2.5 million others displaced in the conflict, which erupted in 2003. Let's get more on this from our correspondent, Mohammed Fazari, who joins us from Khartoum. So at this point, is it final? Is Omar al-Bashir going to be handed over to the ICC, or there are still some more, I guess, phases that this has to go through, or steps that it has to go through before being handed over?
According to a statement made by Karim Khan, the General of International Criminal Court, he said that he wants to confirm the cooperation between the Sudanese government and the ICC in Hague to hand over the President Omar al-Bashir and other wanted people from the Sudanese former official in Sudan. So there is still many steps that the government should do. First, it have to ratify the status of Rome, which is giving the government the full mandate to join ICC, which is the second step that waiting for the joint meeting between the cabinet and the Sovereign Council, so that should be fully ratified, so that the government should start the procedure of handover those wanted by the ICC. So the visit is coming as the first day of the governor of Darfur took over office officially in Darfur. So they are a signal from the Sudanese government that is ready to cooperate with International Criminal Court to hand over all wanted by the ICC, because this is the demands of the people of the victims and also demand of the IDPs in Darfur. So also the peace agreement signed in Juba last October with the Sudanese government and armed movement has strongly stipulated that all people wanted by ICC should be handed over and see justice in The Hague.
At this point, what type of sentence is Omar al-Bashir serving?
Yeah, Omar al-Bashir has been discussed with officials, so there is still ways for how to cooperate with the handing over former President Omar al-Bashir. And we know that former General Prosecutor Fatou Bensouda, he's strongly stressed that Ahmed Haroun and Omar al-Bashir should be handed over last July But there are some legal challenges facing the government to hand over President al-Bashir before ratifying the Statute of Rome, so that there is another meeting, joint meeting between the two councils, which I mean here, the cabinets and the Sovereignty Council, so that they can sign this statute. After that, the government and ICC should discuss the means and possibility of how to hand over, or also discuss how this trial should take place. Some people think that there should be mixed court between the Sudanese judge and a judge from ICC. This is other legal experts say that. But the former prosecutor said there is no way to be mixed court, but only the court should be in under the supervision of ICC in The Hague.
Thank you for that. We appreciate it. Mohammed Fazari, a correspondent there, talking to us from Khartoum. Hundreds of Afghan soldiers have surrendered to the Taliban in a northern provincial capital captured by the militants over the weekend. Local officials say that the soldiers who retreated to the airport of Kunduz City have also turned in all of their military gear. Kunduz is one of the 9 provincial capitals taken by the group in less than a week. Faisalabad is the latest provincial capital to have fallen to the militants following days of heavy fighting. The Taliban have seized dozens of districts and border crossings in recent weeks and is now battling for several key cities. They've intensified their offensive in the wake of the withdrawal of U.S.-led foreign forces. North Korea says that the South and the United States are risking, quote, a huge security crisis by choosing to escalate tensions. State media cited a top Workers' Party official as saying that Seoul and Washington have responded to Pyongyang's goodwill with hostile acts. The statement comes one day after Pyongyang slammed Seoul for going ahead with its annual military exercises with the U.S., even after the North agreed to restore inter-Korean hotlines in late July. On Tuesday, North Korea stopped answering routine calls on the hotlines. The U.S. has more than 28,000 troops in South Korea. Pyongyang has always criticized Washington-Seoul joint military drills and viewed them as a threat. Moving on, the death toll from forest fires in Algeria has risen to 65 as firefighters are struggling to contain the infernos in the country. The Defense Ministry says 28 soldiers were also among those who lost their lives while trying to save residents. More than 70 fires have broken out in 14 states in the north of the country. Also, dozens of fires are burning throughout the Kabylie or Kabylie region east of the capital, Algiers. Authorities say the simultaneous outbreak of fires has raised suspicions of arson streak. Algeria has joined a string of countries hit by major blazes in recent weeks, including Turkey, Greece, Russia, and the U.S. And that does it for World News. It's bye-bye for now.
Fruitful Moments with IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Muharram Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. The name and memory of Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is alive in the hearts of the faithful and freedom seekers after the lapse of centuries. Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, says on his grandson, indeed, Hussein is the beacon of guidance and the ark of salvation. Yes. The Ark of Hussein is sailing throughout the history of mankind, calling on them give up aimlessness and corruption and learn the way of worship of God to reach the coast of dignity and eternal happiness. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, says, O people, God created the servants to know him, in order to worship him and become needless of the worship of anything other than him. Imam Hussein was plunged in monotheism to the extent that every minute aspect of his life manifested this. His words in Mecca and Mina on the course toward Karbala and during the great event of Ashura were all based on monotheism. He says, a group of servants worships God because of their desire for paradise. This is the worship of tradesmen. Another group worships God out of fearing him. This is the worship of slaves. And a group worships God as they find him worthy of worship. This is the worship of free-spirited people. Hussein is the Lord of the free in the world. His famous supplication on the day of Arafah is a rich source of monotheism. In part of the supplication, he says, my God, you are the nearest one to be called, and the fastest to answer, and the noblest to pardon, and the vastest to grant, and the most hearing to ask for. O the merciful of the world and the hereafter, and the compassionate of the both, there is no one to be called like you, and to no one to be wished like you. I called you, and you answered me. I asked from you, and you granted me, and I came to you zealously, and you had mercy on me. I trusted in you, and you saved me. And I took refuge in you, and you sufficed me. Imam Hussein, peace upon him, is so great that the Prophet of Islam said on him, surely Hussein is one of the gates of paradise. The fact that Imam Hussein endured the hardest and bitterest calamities on the day of Ashura without the least doubt and anxiety is because of his inward attention to God. Like his entire life, Hussein was in full remembrance of God on the day of Ashura. He kept calling the enemies to the worship of God as he knew that Yazid was a libertine and corrupt leader and was not worthy of ruling the Islamic Ummah. But when Hussein realized that the hordes of Yazid were blind and deaf towards the truth, he told them, "Satan has dominated you and taken away God's remembrance from your hearts. Shame on you and your wolves. We belong to God, and to Him do we return." Another beautiful aspect of Imam Hussein was his dignity and free spirit. This stemmed from his monotheistic outlook. As he was in full bond with the source of creation, he worshipped only Him and would never worship others in humility. He told those who called on him for an oath of allegiance with Yazid, "Don't you see that the truth is not practiced and the falsehood is not prevented? In such conditions, indeed, a faithful should wish death and meeting God. Thus, I do not see death except salvation and life with oppressors like hardship." Imam Hussein, peace upon him, didn't surrender to the enemy even during the hardest conditions of the battle. He didn't show the least softness that would imply humility. The Epic of Ashura was the picture of freedom, dignity, manliness, and pride. He told the group of people who prevented him from going to Karbala, "You tell me not to go, but I will go. You say that I will be killed. Is the death of a chivalrous man a scandal? Death is scandalous when the goal of man is base and he seeks chairmanship. But it is nor scandalous for the one who is killed to exalt the word of truth and in the way of truth. As he marches in the way of the righteous and the good servants of God." Elsewhere, Imam Hussein says, "Death with dignity is better than life with humility."
In the limelight. New study shows Chinese universities will produce nearly twice as many STEM PhD graduates than the United States by 2025. We're prepared to an article written by Scott Foster, a graduate of Stanford University and the Johns Hopkins University School of Advanced International Studies. The piece is titled "U.S. Falling Further Behind China in STEM PhDs." The article was published by the Asia Times. Earlier article entitled "China-US Contest Will Come Down to Education," I wrote about the crisis in American primary and secondary education. As promised then, this article addresses the relative decline of American universities in the STEM field, science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. This change is not readily apparent. A large share of the best universities in the world are allegedly in the United States. For example, the 7th annual ranking of the best global universities conducted by U.S. News & World Report and published in October of 2020 claimed that 19 of the top 25 schools were American. However, the arguably more internationally minded QS World University Ranking, published by UK company Cockerelli Simons in July this year, found that 12 of the top 25 universities were in the United States, 5 in the United Kingdom, 3 were in China, 2 each in Singapore and Switzerland, and 1 in Japan. Then, at the beginning of August, the Center for Security and Emerging Technology, CSET, at Georgetown University in Washington issued a report entitled China is Fast Outpacing U.S. STEM PhD Growth, which concluded that, based on current enrollment patterns, we project that by 2025, Chinese universities will produce more than 77,000 STEM PhD graduates per year, compared to approximately 40,000 in the United States. Of course, Chinese universities primarily educate Chinese students, while American universities are geared to supposedly educating the world. Thus, the Georgetown University study found, if international students are excluded from the U.S. count, Chinese STEM PhD graduates would outnumber their U.S. counterparts more than 3-1. China overtook the United States in the number of STEM PhDs, that is science, technology, engineering, and mathematics PhDs in 2007, and was 47% ahead by 2019. The change has been rapid, and it remains so. The quality of Chinese university-level STEM education is also improving. The CSET, the Center for Security and Emerging Technology at Georgetown University, study found that most of the recent and rapid growth in Chinese PhD enrollments comes from universities within the higher quality tiers, and because more than three-quarters of Chinese doctoral graduates specialize in STEM fields. This evidence indicates China's STEM talent pipeline is becoming more robust. And not surprisingly, given the scale of China's investments in higher education and the high-stakes technology competition between the United States and China, the gap in STEM PhD production could undermine U.S. long-term economic and national security. Remco Swetsloot, one of the authors of the CSET report, was quoted in Axios' website as warning, "If this continues, there seems to be no way the United States can continue competing with China on the talent front without immigration reform. It is just a numbers game. Because a large percentage of American students are not prepared for graduate studies in science, technology, engineering, and mathematics, the U.S. depends on foreign students to fill its universities and pay the bills. And it has been alienating foreign students, particularly Chinese students, who accounted for about one-third of foreign students in the U.S. before Donald Trump's anti-China rhetoric and tighter immigration controls. Efforts under both Trump and President Biden to exclude Chinese students from advanced STEM research also have had an impact." And according to Xiaofeng Wan, Amherst College Associate Dean of Admission and Coordinator of International Recruitment, There's also been a considerable impact from the physical and verbal violence that ultimately resulted in over 6,600 reported racially motivated attacks against the Asian community, especially the elderly and women. Zhou Feng Wan notes that Chinese students contributed $15 billion to the U.S. economy in the 2018-2019 school year, when enrollments of foreign students peaked. Another report says foreign students' enrollment kept American universities afloat, rising by 55% from 2011 to 2019, while domestic enrollment stagnated. After that, the COVID-19 pandemic caused international student numbers to crash worldwide, and the Delta variant puts recent signs of recovery at risk. President Biden's election has led to a more open immigration policy, but Amherst's Xiaofeng Wan is probably correct when he says that a full recovery to pre-pandemic levels will take time for the Biden administration to simply distance itself from Trump-era anti-immigrant rules and ideologies may not be enough to fully rebuild many Chinese families' lost sense of confidence. Study, a UK-based organization that specializes in study abroad programs, repeats a claim on its website. For decades, the United States has reigned supreme as the world's most popular study abroad destination, but a closer look at its own data shows that while the United States is the country that attracts the largest number of foreign students, in 2019, only 26% of the total number attracted by the top 10 countries surveyed studied in the United States. The United Kingdom, Canada, and Australia together accounted for 32%, and China for 12%. The number of international students in China was almost the same as the number in the United Kingdom, while Canada and Australia were close behind. China attracted 46% as many students as the United States, despite its short history as a country with modern universities. Most foreign students in China are from other Asian countries, led by South Korea, but there are substantial numbers from the United States, Russia, and France. Finally, let's return to the CSET ranking, which includes 100 universities in total. Of these, 29 are in the United States, 17 are in the United Kingdom, 17 in continental Europe, and 12 in China. 5 of those are in Hong Kong, and 1 is in Taiwan, 8 in Australia and New Zealand, 6 in South Korea, 5 in Japan, 3 in Singapore and Malaysia combined, 2 in Canada, and 1 in Argentina. Grouping them culturally and politically shows 29 in the United States, 30 in the British Commonwealth, which does not include Hong Kong, 17 in continental Europe, 12 in Greater China, 11 in South Korea and Japan, and 1 in Latin America. Or 73 in North America, Europe, Australia, and New Zealand, 26 in East Asia, 1 in Latin America, and none at all in South Asia and Africa. Clearly, the scale and diversity of university excellence in the West, the rise of East Asian university education, and the educational weakness of other regions are phenomena as significant as the relative decline of the United States. As Winston Churchill put it in a speech at Harvard University in 1943, the empires of the future are the empires of the mind. China is evolving from cheap hand assembly to fully automated manufacturing and has a huge internet sector. It has built the world's largest high-speed train network, put a rover on Mars, and launched its own space station. All this requires first-rate STEM education, which in China is supported by a government of engineers rather than lawyers. Most likely, when it comes to nation building, the education data will continue to evolve in its favor.
voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
You're listening to Hosseiniya from IRIB English Radio by Sayyid Abbas Razavian. Labbaik Ya Hussein.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alayka Ya Aba Abdullah. I send my deep condolences to you, dear brothers and sisters, for the martyrdom of Imam Hussein alayhi salam and his companions and his family. Welcome to the program Hosseiniyye. It is the month of Muharram. It is a time for us to connect with Imam Hussein, to think about his martyrdom, to think about what happened in Karbala, and for us to benefit and reap the benefits and imply these lessons that we learn from Karbala in our own lives. We talked about the benefits of Ziyarat Ashura. It is one of the great gifts from Imam Muhammad al-Baqir alayhi salam to us. When we look at Ziyarat Ashura, one of the lines in the Ziyarat we read, Ya Aba Abdullah, we address Imam Hussein and say, Laqad Azumat al-Raziyya. Imam Hussein, surely the tribulation is great. What you suffered on the day of Ashura, what happened in Karbala was truly great. It was a true great calamity that happened upon you. It was true bala. وَجَلَّتْ وَعَظُمَتْ الْمُصِيبَةُ بِكْ عَلَيْنَا وَعَلَى جَمِيعَ أَهْلِ الْإِسْلَامِ. Insubstantial, great is your tragedy for us and for all the people of Islam. Meaning that the bala of Imam Hussein is not only for him, that it is also great for us, this tragedy. It is a tragedy that we share. وَجَلَّتْ وَعَظُمَتْ مُصِيبَتُكْ فِي السَّمَاوَاتِ عَلَى جَمِيعَ أَهْلِ السَّمَاوَاتِ. Insubstantial, great is your tragedy in the heavens upon the dwellers of the heavens. Therefore, the tragedy of Karbala is not only for Imam Hussein, it is for us. And it is also for the dwellers of heaven. They understand more what Imam Hussein alayhi salam went through. When we think about bala and calamity, we realize that the calamity of Imam Hussein is in such a way that we cannot truly grasp what Imam Hussein went through. Only Imam Mahdi, living right now, only the prophets, only their successors can truly see what happened to Imam Hussein. For us to understand the bala of Karbala, we first need to understand the position that the Prophet and the Ahlul Bayt had. In some of the traditions we have when he addresses Imam Ali, when he addresses Sayyidah Fatima, when the Holy Prophet is addressed, that if it wasn't for them, Allah wouldn't have created the creation. They are the purpose of creation. So we need to understand that they have a huge significance for the rest of the creation to exist. When we think about the maqam and the position of the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, we can give an example. It is like a person or a company that comes to mine diamonds. When they mine a diamond, they need to excavate an entire huge area, maybe acres of land, and they need to dig up and set up intense and huge facilities to be able to excavate diamonds. And some of these diamonds that come out are worth, are priceless, worth as much as, say, many treasures of the world are. So when we think about the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam, we think of them as diamonds. That Allah wanted to create this universe in the same way to produce such people, such complete people, like the Prophet and Imam Ali and Sayyidah Fatima, Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, that they are true treasures for us. And during this process, say, of excavation, maybe other minerals come out. Maybe other, say, us as normal human beings, we have some worth, but we're not the worth of diamonds. Therefore, for us to understand the greatness of Imam Hussein, we see that Allah wanted to create man and for mankind to produce, and for a group of people that are, their value cannot be measured, and they are the Ahlul Bayt, they are the diamonds of the universe, and they are the purpose of the creation. Therefore, now imagine if a group of people, they give allegiance to Imam Hussein, they write letters to Imam Hussein, but they are the same people, they come and gather around Imam Hussein. And this great Imam, that is the purpose of creation, that now people have gathered to murder him, to abuse him, to oppress him. Imagine what a great calamity this is. The entire purpose that Allah has created us is for the Prophet, is for the Ahlul Bayt, and people are gathering around to attack them. Therefore, this calamity is the worst calamity.
Standing here alone on a land so far from home, a place where angels cry while innocent children die. Hussein has said goodbye, praying some of them survive the torture and the heat. They can't bear to watch him leave. They cry out, Hussein, ya Hussein.
We were talking about bala, which means calamity, tribulation. And we're talking about that the core of Ashura is bala. And that's what the word Karbala has, bala in it, meaning that it is calamity, it is tribulation, it is misfortune. The first step of Ashura was taken by Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And for us to reach a very high station by reciting Ziyarat Ashura, we need to know that the first step is understanding bala. And that is the step that Imam Hussein alayhi salam took. He coped with and dealt with the bala. He was the one that had patience in such tests and tribulations. As you know, brothers and sisters, bala and misfortunes are something that actually increases in rank. When you think of one of the greatest actions that the Ahlul Bayt did, you can think of Karbala, because it is a place where Imam Hussein alayhi salam is being tested, and he's being shown that is he going to choose Allah, or is he going to choose others than Allah? So with this test of Imam Hussein, we understand that bala brings tarfi' for the Ahlul Bayt. It raises their ranks. Even though for us, many times misfortunes happen, bala happens to us because of our own actions. And this is what the Holy Quran says, that it happens because of our own hands. But for the prophets and the Ahlul Bayt, bala happens for them because of tarfi'. They don't have sins, they don't have faults. So Allah wants to elevate them, raise their rank. True, even for us, besides our sins being forgiven, we can be elevated in rank with bala. It has this characteristic. When we think of the greatest test, for example, of Imam Ali alayhi salam, the greatest accomplishment, and what truly showed what Imam Ali was it his strike on the day of Khandaq that we can say was his greatest action? Was it that he slept in the place of the Holy Prophet in Laylatul Mabit, that he slept in his place when they were going to murder and attack the Holy Prophet, and he stayed in his place knowing that he would be attacked and murdered, but then they found out that it was somebody else besides the Holy Prophet? When we look at the life of Imam Ali alayhi salam, one of his greatest tests was that he had to be patient, was that he had to have forbearance when it came to the tragedy that happened to him after the Holy Prophet of Islam passed away. That they took him and they drug him, dragged him on the streets and tied his hands up, and that they martyred his dear wife, Lady Fatima, salamullah alayha. This was the test of Imam Ali. This was the greatest test of Imam Ali. The test of Imam Hussein alayhi salam was Karbala. And this was an action that was not only limited to Imam Hussein. It is an action that the Holy Prophet of Islam prepared. Imam Ali prepared. Lady Fatima prepared. Imam Hassan, Imam Hussein, they all prepared. And that this is connected to Imam Mahdi. So this is a movement of all the Ahlul Bayt alayhi salam. When we think of Ashura, we should not only limit it to Imam Hussein alayhi salam. Therefore, this is the bala and the calamity of Sayyid al-Shuhada of Imam Hussein alayhi salam. And this is one of the best ways that Allah can show how one of his dear and sincere servants can sacrifice everything that he has for Allah and to show his purity and show his forbearance and show his angels. It's very interesting, when Adam was created, the angels were wondering, why have you created such a person that he's going to spill blood? They were complaining. But then when you look at Ziyarat Nahiyah, it says that the same angels, the angels were amazed by the patience of Imam Hussein. Imam Hussein amazed the angels about how much patience can he have, how much can he sacrifice for Allah, and at the same time deal with this bala, and also thank Allah for it, that Allah is giving him this test and raising his rank. So inshallah, this Muharram, we can understand that Imam Hussein alayhi salam, the center of Ziyad Ashura, the center of Ashura is Bala. And this was the great test of Imam Hussein, the great affliction of Imam Hussein. Wa sallallahu ala Sayyidina Muhammadin wa ahl bayti tayyibin tahirin. Salawat.
This is the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave, 31 meters, 9,855 kilohertz for Europe, and 31 meters, 9,835 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and IranSat or Badr 5, and via internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Thank you.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.